Drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KVU. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkvu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of The Beloved Community, every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO, right after Positively Revolting. This Friday, February 9th, I speak with Glenn Montgomery. He's the executive director of the Vision Action Network of Washington County. The mission of the Vision Action Network is to engage stakeholders across sectors to collaboratively address critical issues in Washington County. And some of those issues we will discuss include income inequality, cultural diversity, and housing and houselessness. I will take your phone calls as we work together to build the beloved community. This Friday, February 9th at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock and next is Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned.
Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that our country don't feel like our home, and that silence speaks louder than those who condone. If a tweet to you is worth saving, then lift up your voices and put down your phones, for the times they are a-changing. Come women and men who hashtag me too, and believe me when I say that we believe you, for weak is the man who calls truth fake news. Time's up, our silence we're breaking, and even though Mel Gibson was in Daddy's home too, well, the times, they are a-changing. Come athletes with platforms throughout the land, who by taking a knee are taking a stand, and before you shout out that they should be banned, listen to what they are saying. Perhaps they'd stand up if you reached out your hand. Well, the times, they are a-changing. Come journalists, writers who report the facts, and brandish your pen to fend off his attacks. Look past what he says and look at how he acts. The fire and fury is raging, for his words can hurt, but your words can fight back. New York Times, they aren't a-failing. Come leaders who bully like internet trolls, we'll curse you with four-letter words, love and hope, for we will go high even when you go low. The order is rearranging, for you have the power, but we have the vote. The times, they are a-changing.
It's not working.
It was unbelievable. You killed it. You know you make me nervous, though. When you do that microphone. And you flip the microphone and you spin it around. I can't even do it with a Sharpie. You spin it around.
There, you did it.
Yeah, but then you hit the high note. And I could do this. And I'm like, you know, and I... You did it twice, and maybe I was nervous. I was welling up. I was like...
I'll be honest. No one knows this. We're just... This isn't live, right? We're just in Minneapolis,
no,
right?
We are live. Just we are live.
That's my nervous tick on stage.
Okay, sorry about that, folks. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. Glad to be with you. A little problem with the microphone cords. They were left in a different location. Our apologies. So, yeah, we started out with the... That was not Bob Dylan. That was Jimmy Fallon doing Bob Dylan. Not quite as impressed on the second listening, but give him kudos for effort there. That was his very recent rendition of The Times They Are A-Changin'. I don't know, are the times a-changin'? They seem to be getting worse and worse. Things seem to be going off the rails. 4 fatal Amtrak accidents. Now, is Trump going to take credit for that? All right, so I'm going to read from some articles that I came across, some news I think is worth knowing if you haven't heard about it, or even if you had, maybe you'll hear a little more. And then we're going to have a conversation about recuperation. Okay, so this is from the Atlanta Black Star. FBI tracks and arrests black identity extremist, and hardly anyone is talking about it. By David Love, February 5th, 6 months after the FBI issued a report inventing from whole cloth the term black identity extremists, claiming the group poses a terrorist threat to police. The first apparent case of the prosecution of a BIE, black identity extremist, has emerged. The BIE designation has created concern in the black community that the FBI is launching a new COINTELPRO program targeting black activists who have committed no crimes, with more arrests and prosecutions of those involved in racial justice movements to follow. This latest chapter represents the FBI that has been familiar to black people for decades. While the Bureau only recently created the term black identity extremist, its methods, tactics, and orientation remain the same with regard to black activists. The FBI has a long tradition of treating black political movements as terrorists and enemies of the state and a threat to national security and public safety. A conservative white male-dominated organization, the FBI always has taken its cues from anti-black right-wing propagandists. On December 12th, 2017, in Dallas, Christopher Daniels, also known as Rakim Balogun, was arrested during a raid on his home and charged with the unlawful possession of a firearm, the result of more than 2 years of FBI surveillance, as Foreign Policy reported. Federal agents held Daniels outside in his underwear and seized 2 firearms the government claims he is barred from owning due to a 2007 misdemeanor domestic assault conviction in Tennessee. Among other items FBI agents took from Daniels' home was a copy of the book Negroes with Guns by civil rights activist Robert F. Williams. Williams was the first black leader of his era to support armed resistance to racial oppression. Following the Supreme Court's 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, Williams had revived the Monroe, North Carolina chapter of the NAACP amid Ku Klux Klan violence. In response to assaults on black women that were ignored by police, he organized black workers and veterans, filed for a charter from the NRA, and formed the Black Armed Guard. The group repelled Klan violence against integration and protected the Freedom Riders. Williams also internationalized the black struggle as he and his family lived in Cuba, where he wrote his book and produced Radio Free Dixie, and China for a number of years. I advocated violent self-defense because I don't really think you can have a defense against violent racists, against terrorists, unless you are prepared to meet violence with violence, and my policy was to meet violence with violence, said Williams, a forefather of the Black Power Movement and the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Now, that's a background to this Christopher Daniels, who was arrested in Dallas again as a supposed black identity extremist. Now, this is, that's all the article of that that I copied out here. It's interesting. I don't know if people got wind of this. The Southern Poverty Law Center has names. Now, they're not saying that they're black identity extremists. I want to get that real clear. But they have named a number of African-American organizations on their hate group list, a couple of them being Portland groups. Unfortunately, I didn't think I was going to talk about this, so I didn't copy this out. But there's some people who take issue with that, saying that while these groups may have views that, anyway, this is a complicated subject I'm not really prepared to talk about. Let's just leave it at there's some controversy about the inclusion of some of these groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center and whether or not they're actually a threat. I just thought that was interesting in connection to this, but again, it has nothing to do with the FBI's new program to track and arrest black identity extremists. Okay, local news, judge clears way for $1.2 billion lawsuit against Bullseye Glass. This is an issue of major, major interest, especially to residents of the Powell Boulevard to Colgate inner southeast general area and wider. It's there's differences about how wide the area is that Bullseye should be responsible for compensating people for. So a judge ruled in favor of a group of residents Friday, allowing them to move forward with a $1.2 billion class action lawsuit against a Southeast Portland glassmaker. Bullseye Glass stopped using the chemicals cadmium and arsenic in its glass production in 2016 after air monitoring stations detected high levels of the chemicals against around the company. Prompting concerns for nearby residents and daycare center, the company also said it stopped using chromium a week later. The company later resumed using cadmium after installing an updated filtration system known as a bag house. Dozens of people packed the courthouse in downtown Portland, listened to both sides as both sides presented their cases. The plaintiffs argued the lawsuit should move forward based on their research that shows hundreds of people were potentially affected by dangerous chemicals coming from the facility. The defense disagreed. So that's that. That will be interesting to see how that proceeds. That was from KAT News Online by Catherine Kissel. This from The Nation. The FBI is setting up a task force to monitor social media, but is the worst possible candidate for the job, by Chris Gibbons, February 1st. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is not accustomed to suspecting domestic dissidents of being foreign, not unaccustomed to suspecting domestic dissidents of being foreign agents. Of course, interesting in the current context. The Bureau infamously thought everyone from civil rights activists to the peace movement to opponents of South African apartheid were the tools of communists and thus the Soviet Union, which is why the FBI's announcement that its task force to counter foreign influence and disinformation has plans to monitor social media should be raising serious questions. The rhetoric around Russiagate is increasingly mirroring that of the Cold War FBI, and in some cases resurrecting some of the most insidious tendencies. No matter who is tasked with monitoring or regulating social media, serious concerns about free speech arise. Allowing Silicon Valley to self-police is to essentially entrust unaccountable corporations with regulating our modern public square. Congressional committees, while the most democratic form of oversight, can also have chilling effects on speech. Yet, whatever concerns may exist about these other bodies, the FBI is the worst possible candidate for the job. Recent public comments indicate the FBI will alert both private companies and the public to social media-based foreign influence in the upcoming election. It is then up to social media providers and the public to decide how to respond. There doesn't have to be state-mandated censorship for this system to threaten free expression. Allowing the nation's top law enforcement agency to designate speech as foreign disinformation is inherently chilling. The FBI itself seems aware of how bad this idea sounds like from a First Amendment standpoint. A FBI spokesperson proclaimed, "We're not here to be the thought police." That's obviously clearly not something that we would ever want to get into. Yeah. Now, this is all very interesting. I don't know if people have been seeing, there's some parodies, you know, saying that, you know, what are the hippies or 60s activists, you know, they're caught now because they feel like they have to support the FBI in this current tug of war with the Trump White House. But as we know, the FBI has a very bad track record, and I suspect they're more wanting to get on board with the White House than not. But you know, who knows where all this is going? Probably end up in the Supreme Court. Okay, here from CNN, this is the fourth fatal crash involving an Amtrak train in 2 months by Darren Simon, CNN Online. This was Sunday's train collision in South Carolina. The fourth fatal incident involving Amtrak train since the start of December. That's extraordinary. The circumstances surrounding each crash vary. In two cases, vehicles appear to have driven around the lowered arm of a train crossing. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating three of the collisions, including Sunday's. And of course, we know that just yesterday or the day before, a train going 125 miles an hour got disconnected. The hitch that connected two of the passenger cars was disconnected, and they remained only connected by hoses. If someone had been going between the cars, they would have been killed. And it goes on to describe the three fatal accidents, South Carolina, of course, right up here in Washington State. Earlier, Virginia, with the train carrying Republican congressional members, and North Carolina on January 14. Now, is this a result of deregulation? Could that happen that fast? Seems unlikely. We know that Amtrak is chronically unfunded. We know that it's very likely that this administration is as or more hostile to public train systems than previous ones. Of course, I don't know which administration you can see Amtrak being funded to the extent that it needs to be. I know that I think the latest fatal accident where the Amtrak train was mistakenly diverted onto the sidetrack and collided with a freight train, leading to deaths and many injuries, over 100 injuries, I believe, two deaths, I think. That's also a result of the fact that the privately owned freight trains own the vast majority of the tracks. And so even if Amtrak wanted to make necessary changes that would improve their service, they are stymied. My argument is that we should regionalize. If I were emperor of the United States, I would regionalize the service, nationalize it, but then put it into like regional boards controlled regionally, completely take over all the tracks, put them in public hands, upgrade all the tracks. I wouldn't go to high-speed trains. I would go to a much more extensive local and regional train system. But of course, I'm not in charge, and those who think like me, we are not in charge. And in fact, things are going drastically off the rails, as I said. Okay, you just heard on Democracy Now! Amy Goodman talking about this. FEMA contract called for 30 million meals for Puerto Ricans. 50,000 were delivered. This is in the New York Times. Just yesterday, the mission for the Federal Emergency Management Agency was clear. Hurricane Maria had torn through Puerto Rico and hungry people needed food. 30 million meals needed to be delivered as soon as possible. For this huge task, FEMA tapped Tiffany Brown, an Atlanta entrepreneur with no experience in large-scale disaster relief, and at least five canceled government contracts in her past. FEMA awarded her $156 million for the job, and Mrs. Brown, who is the sole owner and employee of her company, Tribute Contracting LLC, set out to find some help. Ms. Brown, who was adept at navigating the federal contracting system, hired a wedding caterer in Atlanta with a staff of 10 to freeze-dry wild mushrooms and rice, chicken and rice, and vegetable soup. She found a nonprofit in Texas that had shipped food and aid overseas and domestically, including to a Houston food bank after Hurricane Harvey. By the time 18.5 million meals were due, Tribute had delivered only 50,000, and FEMA inspectors discovered a problem. The food had been packaged separately from the pouches used to heat them. FEMA's solicitation required self-heating meals. Do not ship another meal. Your contract is terminated. Carolyn Ward, the FEMA contracting officer who handled Tribute's agreement. That's like closing the barn door after all the cows were out. Looks like we got a caller who wants to actually talk about Amtrak. I was, of course, going to go in my own little personal direction here, but I'm open to people talking about what they want to talk about today. Of course, I just want to follow up. Marianne, hold on just a second here. This FEMA contract is on the heels, of course, of that disastrous contract that went to the tiny Montana outfit to redo the electrical grid in Puerto Rico. And who knows where all these, how many other scandals will come out as the days and weeks, and whether there will be any accountability. Obviously, the Republicans are basically held hostage to and holding Trump hostage, both. He's their man, and they can't go back. So they're gonna double down, it seemingly, and not allow any substantive critiques, let alone talk of impeachment. Okay. I've said my piece to start out the show. It's 8:20 in the morning. The phone number to call in and participate this morning on any of the subjects I brought up is 503-231-8187. Hello, Marianne.
Yeah, hi. Well, you've got so many good things to talk about. Thank you for everything that you said. Yeah, but I'm a big Amtrak supporter, and you're the first person that I've heard speak out publicly on the radio saying we ought to nationalize the rails. I mean, that's wonderful. We're like the only industrialized country, maybe the only country in the world that hasn't done that, that still has privately owned rails.
Well, of course, the UK went back on their, they've dismantled their public rail system and privatized it to this bewildering number of different services, and it's a total disaster. So yeah, we see what happens when you start dismantling and privatizing.
Yeah. I mean, this latest crash was obviously the railroad's fault. They're the ones that own the rails. They're the ones that provide the dispatchers. They're the ones that change the switches. So it was totally their fault. So I hope that we don't hear, about how terrible Amtrak is, because they're doing the best they can with.
Well, that's the danger. I mean, that's the way these things go. It's like you defund, you starve the necessary services so that they're not functioning, and then you blame them for not functioning properly. It's a old trick, tried and true.
It's disgusting. Yeah, my understanding about the Washington crash was that this engineer was, you're supposed to have a second person in the cab all the time, and their job is to notice. One of their jobs is to call out every signal that they pass. Because one person can't keep track of everything they need to keep track of. I mean, they've got to watch their gauges. They've got to watch the outside of the train. It's not. And the freight railroads are trying to. I don't know if they've actually succeeded in this, but they're trying to get rid of. You know, they got rid of the brakemen back in 1991. Remember that? The cabooses, no longer cabooses on the train. And now they're trying to get it down to where there's only one person in the cab. I mean, it's terribly dangerous. It's insane.
That's interesting, because the another of the proposed solution is this, I forget the name of this, very sophisticated
positive train control.
Right. And, that sounds good, but at the same time, this tendency to go more and more towards technological solutions obviously cuts jobs, which is what the whole trend. And, maybe maybe the technological solutions aren't the be-all and end-all. Maybe what you're saying is actually you need more people to do what the jobs that need to be done.
Yeah, well, that's why they got rid of the brakeman. They claimed, well, we've got all this electronic equipment now that can detect when the brakes are not working, so we don't need the brakeman. But you do. You still need people. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, yeah, thank you for talking about this.
Yeah, no, it's an important subject. You know, I lived in Italy for over a decade, and I witnessed the Italian system start to go in similar directions. They started to, I mean, it was you know, just an amazing coming from the United States. You know, you almost see nothing to criticize until you really start seeing what's really going on behind the scenes, because it, you know, it was very functional. You had still had a large number of local and regional lines, you know, students, commuters, just everybody using the trains on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you had this this building of this high-speed train line, which was basically superseding the local, regional, and inter-regional trains, and basically cutting out a lot of local stations, a lot of local lines, a lot of regional lines were being eliminated, which were really the lifeblood of the people who use the system, and instigating these higher speed, longer, higher priced routes, mainly used by tourists and business people, more, and then people are being forced to use it, then they have to pay more money. Anyway, it's why I'm very skeptical of high speed train in general, but that's a subject that's not very popular with a lot of people.
No, it isn't. Well, I didn't realize that. That's interesting. But high speed rail is not a bad idea, but you need the lower speed rail as a foundation to build it on, partly just to connect to all the local smaller places, because the high speed's not going to stop as many places.
Well, you said it. That's a good way of putting it, because I would be down with, you know, maybe some very carefully selected high-speed rail routes if you had that foundation. But to basically leap over and go right into high-speed rail, I think, is a huge mistake.
Oh, you can't do it. It won't work. Yeah, but I mean, it's very glamorous. So people say, oh, high-speed rail, wonderful.
Yeah.
But they don't understand. You've got to have a whole system there working together.
Of course, you know, as we see, though, it's not likely any of these things are going to happen, because we're going in the wrong direction. These accidents aren't helping poor old Amtrak, that's for sure.
Yeah, right. But it's really good to hear people speaking out and saying it's not Amtrak's fault. It's,
Other
places, the place to blame. So, anyway, you had so many good subjects. I don't want to monopolize with this, but thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks for mm-hmm. getting interest in that and contributing your voice to our airwaves here on KBOO Community Radio. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and join the conversation. I've introduced quite a few subjects. I had another one I wanted to talk about, if there aren't other callers to call in on those particular. I had another article I wanted to briefly mention. Here comes the next financial crisis. Trump's deregulators are setting the economy on fire. This comes from, I don't have where it came from, but apparently it originally appeared on TomDispatch.com. There's been lots of fire and fury around Washington lately, including a brief government shutdown in Donald Trump's White House. You can hardly keep up with the ongoing brouhahas from North Korea to Robert Mueller's Russian investigation. Well, it already feels like ages since the celebratory mood over the vast corporate tax cuts Congress passed last year. But don't be fooled. None of that is as important as what's missing from the picture. Like a disease in the nation's capital, it's often what you can't see that will, in the end, hurt you most. Amid a roaring stock market and a planet of upbeat CEOs, few are even thinking about the havoc that a multi-trillion dollar financial system gone rogue could inflict upon global stability. But watch out, even in the seemingly best of times, neglecting Wall Street is a dangerous idea. Of course, this happened before this 1,000-point or whatever correction, blip, downturn that happened to I don't know what, you know, what did they say? They said that was due to concern over rising wages, possible inflationary. I think, you know, I wonder if something else is going on, but that's just my sort of paranoid mind. Anyway, amid a roaring stock market and a planet. Oh, no, that's what I just read. Sorry about that. With a ragtag Trumpian crew of ex-bankers and Goldman Sachs alumni as the only watchdogs in town, it's time to focus. Because one thing is clear, Donald Trump's economic team is in the process of making the financial system combustible again. Collectively, the biggest U.S. banks already have their get-out-of-jail-free cards and are now sitting on record profits after not so long ago triggering sweeping unemployment, wrecking countless lives, and elevating global instability. Anyway, this is a I guess it's going to take too long to get into the meat of this article, which is actually quite long, which, again, the title is Here Comes the Next Financial Crisis. Trump's deregulators are setting the economy on fire. They're talking about the limitations of Dodd-Frank, how they're getting around Dodd-Frank. Jay Clayton, the Securities of Exchange and Exchange Commission, and on. Anyway, goes on. Another article I want to flag, The Bankruptcy of the American Left by Chris Hedges in Truth Dig, which kind of goes along the lines of what the subject I was originally going to talk about, which is the idea of recuperation, which kind of goes along the theme that I've been talking about recently, is postmodernism and the fallout from the 1960s. I've been meaning to do a series of programs on the legacy of the 1960s since KBOO was started in 1968 by the 60s generation. And I don't think we've really fully come to terms with what a defeat that was and how we've still are living in the defeat of the last great wave, international wave of movements against the dominant system, capitalist, colonial, and otherwise. And an article I read at that time talked about the whole shift from sort of a large-scale movement type leftist, anti-capitalist, steeped in the Marxist tradition to a much more diffuse approach, which has had a certain amount of power in its ability to focus more on marginalized and oppressed groups and form a stronger sense of identity in the face of the disastrous forces of disintegration and oppression of the modernity and capitalism, but have also had the effect of creating a lot of barriers and separations to people actually coming together in a more unified manner. And again, this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. This is kind of a free-for-all show today. 503-231-8187 is a number to call in on. Okay, so recuperation is a term that I've mentioned in the past. I will give some definitions here. In the sociological sense, it's the process by which politically radical ideas and images are twisted, co-opted, absorbed, and diffused, incorporated, annexed, and commodified within media culture and bourgeois society, and thus become interpreted through a neutralized, innocuous, or more socially conventional perspective. More broadly, it may refer to the cultural appropriation of any subversive works or ideas by mainstream culture. It is the opposite of détournement, in which images and other cultural artifacts are appropriated from mainstream sources and repurposed with radical intentions. The concept in political philosophy of recuperation was first proposed by Pietro Staheli, a Swiss member of the Situation International. His first paper on the subject, The Ruins of was the ruins of Fordism. The term conveys a negative connotation because recuperation generally bears the intentional consequence, whether perceived or not, of fundamentally altering the meanings behind radical ideas due to their appropriation or being co-opted into the dominant discourse. Examples, this is from Wikipedia, by the way, pointing to the, quote, erosion of publicly owned media and capitalist realism, Aaron Bastani wrote of the recuperation of the internet by capital, saying that the consequences of this persistent corporate media recuperation included a reinforcement of status quo, repression and dissent, and artistic expression. Okay, so that's one take on recuperation. Why am I talking about this? I'm talking about this because we have this incredibly disastrous, almost farcically tragic, tragically farcical situation of imminent doomsday due to total biological meltdown and climate catastrophe, which is whose effects are beginning, widespread effects are beginning to be seen more and more. And there seems to be a absolute paralysis towards actually confronting it. And then we've got Trump in the White House, and we've got the fossil fuel industry back in at the reins of power. Dick Cheney energy policy being implemented into the full extent possible, and now that they've got their man in the White House, their strange man in the White House. So we've got this absolutely disastrous situation, yet there seems to be still on the part of the left or the oppositional forces an unwillingness to introspect and to deeply, collectively address some of the long-standing illusions and internal contradictions that have prevented us from becoming a force to be reckoned with. As I said, ever since the 60s, even though, of course, the 60s, those contradictions were embodied as well. Okay, so we got John on the line. Let's go ahead and hear what John has to say.
Hi, I'll bring up a quote, and then I'll throw out a theory. Yogananda called this generation, this incurious generation, and even though we've got smartphones and access to so much information, such a large percentage of the population is not curious enough to dig into any subject. And so my theory is that the Trump administration may be dismantling everything so that they can create so much chaos that it's easy for a full-blown dictatorship to be installed. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think Naomi Klein has laid out that scenario, which has worked on numerous occasions in the past. Countries all over the world have been subject to what she calls the shock doctrine. I think she introduced a very helpful term to understand how when confronted with crisis and or opposition, the dominant powers do is not just repress, but repress in such a big way that you just don't even know what hit you, and you're have difficulty. You know, people, we're all having difficulty getting our feet on the ground and getting our minds around what's happening to begin with, and then you add just assault after assault after assault after assault, and it and of course the most marginalized and oppressed people, communities have already suffering more assaults and already struggling to get their feet under them. And, you know, you get things like Black Lives Matter, and they get these responses like this Black Identity Extremists category that the FBI throws out, and you get the Trump White House. You know, just you know when we had Black Lives Matter, we had the Standing Rock movement. Things it seemed like things were, you know, picking up again a little bit of that 60s fervor and some cross-fertilization happening. And, you know, the result seems to be a total reaction. It's like, it seems like the reaction time is dwindling. You know, it took a while to get Reagan in the White House, whose job was to put the nail in the coffin of the 60s. And now they can't wait. Well, because everything's just speeding up so rapidly. You know, we've got what's happening with the stock market? What's it, over 30,000? I mean, this is just bizarre. It's obviously unsustainable. The elites who, you know, seemingly are in control are clearly not in control. Everything's going off the rails. So the only solution they can muster is to just apply more of the same old, same old. Anyway, you probably don't want to hear me talk. I didn't really want to hear myself talk. I'd like to hear what other people have to say about these various subjects that have been raised. 503-231-8187. So I'm going to read a little bit from the Anarchist Library talking about recuperation. I'm doing this because I think, you know, like the shock doctrine is a very useful concept. I find recuperation is a very useful concept because what happens is we get recuperated away from a more grounded, foundational, radical perspective, often because we don't have other people to talk to about it, because we're so busy in our daily lives. Working, you know, we don't have a social milieu that's conducive towards these kind of conversations. So I think it's important to get these kind of key concepts to help us get traction on this slippery reality that we're in. So recuperation and detournement. Recuperation is a channeling of social revolt in a way that perpetuates capitalism. To understand recuperation is to understand how working class struggles are kept under control and how working class demands become integrated into capital strategy. To understand recuperation is to understand that it is a central function of the media and of modern unions. Punk rock culture being sold in boutique stores is an instance of recuperation. Of course, it is the inability of punk rock culture to effectively challenge anything that opens up to so completely to recuperation. Well, I don't know. Poor old punk rock, it's putting a lot on their shoulders. But the left, as capital's loyal opposition, is the embodiment of political recuperation, or keeping things within the realm of politics and representation. Detournement is something like the opposite of recuperation. It is the appropriation of images or ideas and the changing of their intended meaning in a way that challenges the dominant culture. Okay, so we've got Bill to interrupt, thankfully. So let's hear what Bill has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
You mentioned something about the stock market and this unpredictable thing. I think that it's just the opposite. When you have all of our monetary policy being based or created by those who have influence in Wall Street, I think we have to remember that the real notion behind the stock market is that someone has to lose for someone to win. And 2008 was a prime example of how many won while the mass majority lost. But I want to comment about the idea that there's something else that's going on economically. And when you listen to the rich talk about repatriating wealth back to America, even through tax cuts, when the money was free to them, there was an incentive to keep their money elsewhere. When you're sitting on massive piles of cash and you want to get even richer, you don't necessarily bring it back and start creating jobs. You drive up the interest rate, which is happening right now, so that you can continue to make money off of the money that you just got a big tax break on. So I think we really need to stop and ask ourselves, is this system in chaos, or is it just really fluctuating so that those who get rich continue to get richer? And I think that's the real key behind having, I guess, neutral individuals really shape our policy and ask why, when we talk about deregulation, that we're still deregulating Wall Street and attacking individuals who want to see transparency, and yet this is what we continue to go down no matter what we do. We have the fox watching the fox, who's all watching the hen house. So it's like, what do we really have?
Well, I just one quick question. So are those things mutually exclusive? The fact that the system is in chaos and the fact that it's running as designed?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think that when we talk about this idea of what it's chaotic to me, the guy who gets up and goes to work every day, and I'm being told that, you know, you need to invest in the market and you need to make money. That's not chaotic when you think about there's a portion of the market where individuals actually bet on chaos. I mean, they're betting that the market is going to fluctuate. So it's not like it's this deal where we're playing this game. Some are playing the game, but they're also making the rules to the game so that they always win. I think that's really the key here, is what, like, who's shaping the policy? And if it's Wall Street bankers who are shaping the policy, I think it would be foolish to believe that they're going to shape policy that's fair to the everyday guy.
Well, you know, and obviously,
not their bottom line.
Obviously, and so the task is to somehow get the power to completely overturn the dominant economic setup.
I think that we have reached a point where in our culture. I tell most people that many of the individuals that I guess are behind the policies, the ideas, our politics, they think 30, 40 years out. We think about next year, next week, tomorrow. And so if we're not thinking as a group of people or have the notion that it's never going to end, we're talking about a struggle between power and people. And power has always fought to maintain it. I guess it's kind of like the pendulum, and it swings. And if we do not continue to push the pendulum, even when we think that we have won, it's just a matter of time before we give that ground back. And I really believe that's what regulation is. That's what our political process is. And I think that we have to become very dogged in our ideas, not necessarily one-sided, but dogged with the idea that if you're fighting for civil rights, you're going to have to continue to fight for it. Because what's popular with one side isn't popular with the other. So if we're talking about regulation, if we're talking about environmental concerns, we can never let up. And we always have to have legacy to back that up. That's what the wealthy have. That's what corporations have. The ability to live on forever through corporation is called legacy. And until we have a society that sets up legacy, it's always going to somehow, I guess, be undermined by those who have the ability to think well beyond where we are as people.
Amen. I can't disagree with anything.
Have a good day.
All right, you too. All right, Bill. And and we got Ted up. Go ahead, Ted. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, K-Boo. With the conversations with Trump here yesterday where he's complaining that the Democrats are all un-American and actually treasonous, it seems to me like something that would come out of the Kremlin, which would then lead me to believe that we got Russian spies in the White House.
I've heard that theory. It's interesting. I read an article that said that Trump ought to be careful about bringing up the term treason because it might come back to bite him. But I don't. That means there's got to be where the thing is. You know, where is the counterweight? I mean, I'm bemoaning the fact that there isn't, you know, the kind of mass movement that many of us would love dearly to see miraculously arise in the face of the situation. So there isn't really at this point you know, a popular counterweight. The institutional counterweights, the Democratic Party is showing their miserable colors once again, basically being defanged. It's unclear whether the Supreme Court will, you know, where they will fall on a full-blown constitutional crisis, which everybody talks about. We seem to be possibly moving towards. There's certainly cultural counterweights. The Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter, are counterweights that are having, you know, an effect in important realms. But you know, in terms of a semi-fascist, fascist, neo-fascist type of administration that we've got in power, I have serious doubts about whether there will be a counterweight to where they're going, but I don't know.
Well, I don't know why anybody would think that Trump and Putin aren't still cooperating to do some damage to this country.
Well, interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you think their interests? Their interests. Where do their interests coincide?
Domination.
Uh huh. So you think? Okay, I mean, that's possible. I think it seems a little more complex than that. It seems like there's still, you know, it seems like there's also jockeying for position and power in addition to, it doesn't seem like they're completely on the same page.
All Russian spies in the White House.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
All right, well, thanks for that. That's, I guess, what Ted wanted to say, that there's Russian spies in the White House. All right, we got Harvey up. Go ahead, Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, you know, the Trump administration is a fully owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry, and really, it really is time for us to take personal power, and that's clean power. And, you know, New York just divested billions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry. I'd like to see Portland follow suit, and reinvest in clean renewable energy. And Trump administration wants to drill offshore, and that could affect fracking, which causes earthquakes. Offshore fracking could affect the Cascadia subduction zone, which could cause a 9-point Fukushima like earthquake.
Our way to get back political power is through clean energy. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. Say the Portland fleet of vehicles, you know, why not move to electric vehicles?
But what if you don't have the political power to, you know, implement those policies? It seems like the cart before the horse.
Well, that's where we all come in. We have to vote with our dollars here.
Okay.
We have to take personal responsibility, put solar panels on our roofs, drive electric cars. We have to take responsibility because our government is owned by the fossil fuel industry, and now is the time for us to stand up, and instead of just going oh me oh my, is to start with your local city and local governments and move toward clean renewable energy and set examples for other cities.
All right. Well, thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
And we got about 6-7 minutes left. If you want to get a call in on what we've talked about or something entirely different. Obviously, my discussion of recuperation hasn't elicited great interest in the listenership, which is fine. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and we're talking about a bunch of different things, talking about the weirdness getting weirder in this world, and how we're moving in some direction collectively or not. So, let's read a little more about this. Basically talking about the situation is international. That's where the term recuperation originally came from. So here we go. Alienation and separations. In the 1844 manuscripts, Marx put forward his critique of alienation. He observed that the capitalist relationship of wage labor puts the worker in the position of being forced to sell his labor power, his time and energy, his or her, to the capitalist in order to survive. his or her working activity, or their working activity, I should say, is therefore not an expression of their desires and creative capacity, but a forced labor that confronts the worker as an alien imposition dictated by someone else. It's almost kind of like rubbing it in, when, you know, to remind people that this is the case. I think it's partly why we resist thinking, engaging more with these ideas, because what are you going to do about it? It's just the way it is. The worker alienates their labor power in order to receive a wage. This circumstance, Marx observed, alienates, one, the laborer from the product of their labor, since they do not determine their fate; two, the laborer from the act of labor, since the labor process is dictated by the capitalist; three, he says man here, but of course that's an older formulation, from his species being, his nature and intellectual species power is determined by the course of human development; and for man from man, workers do not determine their activity together, and a capitalist stands above them as a tyrant. I could get deeper into this, but it looks like we got Scott wants to contribute to our conversation this morning. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for putting me on. I would say get out of a person's car and get on a bicycle. That's one of the answers. And Portland used to be known as number one bicycling city in the country. I don't know if that's true or if it's still true.
So that's going to stop Trump, huh?
Well, it'll certainly make the demand for gasoline a lot less, and it'll make global warming less of a factor if people rode bicycles like, God, they did in China. They used to, and now they're all going to cars over there. They're going backwards, I think. I don't know. But anyway, just a thought.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. My take on that is always, sure. I mean, I actually drove in today, but I rode my bike in yesterday. I try to ride and take the bus as much as possible, more than driving the car. And so, of course, I think that's good. Obviously, there's people who are unable to. There's circumstances that people can't. We need a better mass transit system, obviously. Cheaper. Free? Crazy idea. How would you do that? How would you pay for it? You might have to completely restructure our social system. Seemingly impossible. Anyway, we try to throw out a few ideas here. That's about all, really. I mean, it's not anything more than that. We're not really doing anything here. Just talking. But it's interesting to have a public conversation, and we'd like to find more opportunities for them. I want to thank Jimmy Fallon for, doing his little Bob Dylan imitation, which we put. It's on YouTube. I'd like to see Dylan do that version, or his own retake of The Times They Are Changing. All right. Well, I guess I've talked about enough. We've got a little bit of John Prine to go out with before our next programming here on KBOO. Thanks for listening.
He caught a train from Alexandria, just a broken man in a flight, running scared with all his devils, saying prayers all through the night. But mercy can't find him, not in the shadows where he calls, forsaking all his better angels. That's how every empire falls.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The engineering committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct in Portland. On February 9th, 2017, teenager Quanise Moose Hayes was shot 3 times by police, once in the head execution style, kneeling and trying to follow conflicting police commands. This peaceful protest is in memory of Moose. Again, that's the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February the 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct, 737 Southeast 106th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you for the remainder of the morning until noon. Briefly, what's coming up is the Politics of Living at very soon. Politics of Living with your host, Denise Kowalczyk. And at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, news, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, we got the bike show. So stay tuned for all of that great programming coming to you on Community Radio, KBOO.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Bonnie Michelle. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it is using the power of words to speak your truth or understanding of sex in our culture to preparing the perfect mushroom soup. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Tave Fache Drake and Brian Delaney, hosts of the podcast Peace, Love, and Soup, celebrated National Homemade Soup Day on February